The Man in the High Castle, Cassette 2.
The loudspeaker at the end of the aisle said, Achtung, meine Damen und Herren! In his seat, Mr. Baines started, opened his eyes. Through the window to his right, he could see, far below, the brown and green of land and then blue, the Pacific. The rocket, he realized, had begun its long, slow descent. In German first, then Japanese, and at last English, the loudspeaker explained that no one was to smoke or to untie himself from his padded seat. The descent, it explained, would take 8 minutes. The retro jet started then, so suddenly and loudly, shaking the ship so violently that a number of passengers gasped. Mr. Baines smiled, and in the aisle seat across from him, another passenger, a younger man with close-cropped blonde hair, also smiled. Sie fürchten das, the young man began, but Mr. Baines said at once, in English, I'm sorry, I don't speak German. The young German gazed at him questioningly, and so he said the same thing in German. No German? The young German said, amazed, in accented English. I am Swedish, Baines said. You embarked at Tempelhof. Yes, I was in Germany on business. My business carries me to a number of countries. Clearly, the young German could not believe that anyone in the modern world, anyone who had international business dealings and rode, could afford to ride on the latest Lufthansa rocket, could or would not speak German. To Baines, he said, What line are you in, mein Herr? Plastics, polyesters, resins, ersatz industrial uses. Do you see? No consumers' commodities. Sweden has a plastics industry? Disbelief. Yes, a very good one. If you will give me your name, I will have a firm brochure mailed to you. Mr. Baines brought out his pen and pad. Never mind. It would be wasted on me. I am an artist, not a commercial man. No offense. Possibly you have seen my work while on the continent. Alex Lotze. He waited. Afraid I do not care for modern art, Mr. Baines said. I like the old pre-war cubists and abstractionists. I like a picture to mean something, not merely to represent the ideal. He turned away. But that's the task of art, Lotze said, to advance the spirituality of man over the sensual. Your abstract art represented a period of spiritual decadence, of spiritual chaos, due to the disintegration of society, the old plutocracy. The Jewish and capitalist millionaires, the international set that supported the decadent art. Those times are over. Art has to go on. It can't stay still. Baines nodded, gazing out the window. Have you been to the Pacific before? Lotze asked. Several times. Not I. There is an exhibition in San Francisco of my work, arranged by Dr. Goebel's office with the Japanese authorities. A cultural exchange to promote understanding and goodwill. We must ease tensions between the East and West, don't you think? We must have more communication, and art can do that. Baines nodded. Below, beyond the ring of fire from the rocket, the city of San Francisco and the bay could now be seen. Where does one eat in San Francisco? Lotze was saying. I have reservations at the Palace Hotel, but my understanding is that one can find good food in the international section, such as the Chinatown. True, Baines said. Are prices high in San Francisco? I am out of pocket for this trip. The ministry is very frugal. Lotze laughed. Depends on the exchange rate you can manage. I presume you're carrying Reichsbank drafts. I suggest you go to the Bank of Tokyo on Samson Street and exchange there. Danke sehr, Lotze said. I would have done it at the hotel. The rocket had almost reached the ground. Now Baines could see the airfield itself. Hangars, parking lots, the autobahn from the city, the houses. Very lovely view, he thought. mountains and water and a few bits of fog drifting in at the Golden Gate. "What is that enormous structure below?" Lotsa asked. "It is half finished, open at one side, a spaceport?" "The Nipponese have no spacecraft," I thought. With a smile, Bane said, "That's Golden Poppy Stadium, the baseball park." Lotsa laughed. "Yes, they love baseball. Incredible. They have begun work on that great structure for a pastime, an idle, time-wasting sport." Interrupting, Bane said, "It is finished. That's its permanent shape, open on one side. A new architectural design. They are very proud of it." "It looks," Lotze said, gazing down, "as if it was designed by a Jew." Baines regarded the man for a time. He felt strongly for a moment the unbalanced quality, the psychotic streak in the German mind. Did Lotze actually mean what he said? Was it a truly spontaneous remark? "I hope we will see one another later on in San Francisco," Lotze said as the rocket touched the ground. "I will be at loose ends without a countryman to talk to." "I'm not a countryman of yours," Bane said. "Oh, yes, that's so, but racially you're quite close. For all intents and purposes, the same." Lotze began to stir around in his seat, getting ready to unfasten the elaborate belts. "Am I racially kin to this man?" Baines wondered. "So closely so that for all intents and purposes it is the same? Then it is in me, too, the psychotic streak. A psychotic world we live in. The madmen are in power. How long have we known this, faced this? And how many of us do know it, not Lotze? Perhaps if you know you are insane, then you are not insane. Or you are becoming sane, finally. Waking up. I suppose only a few are aware of all this. Isolated persons here and there. But the broad masses, what do they think? All these hundreds of thousands in this city here, do they imagine that they live in a sane world? Or do they guess, glimpse, the truth? But, he thought, what does it mean, insane? A legal definition. What do I mean? I feel it, see it. But what is it? He thought, it is something they do, something they are. It is their unconsciousness, their lack of knowledge about others, their not being aware of what they do to others, the destruction they have caused and are causing. No, he thought, that isn't it. I don't know. I sense it, intuit it, but they are purposely cruel. Is that it? No. God, he thought, I can't find it. Make it clear. Do they ignore parts of reality? Yes, but it is more. It is their plans, yes. Their plans. The conquering of the planets. Something frenzied and demented, as was their conquering of Africa, and before that Europe and Asia. Their view, it is cosmic, not of a man here, a child there, but an abstraction, race, land, folk, land, blut, Ehre. Not of honorable men, but of Ehre itself, honor. The abstract is real, the actual is invisible to them. Die Güter, but not good men, this good man. It is their sense of space and time. They see through the here and now into the vast black deep beyond, the unchanging, and that is fatal to life. Because eventually there will be no life. There was once only the dust particles in space, the hot hydrogen gases, nothing more. And it will come again. This is an interval, ein Augenblick. The cosmic process is hurrying on, crushing life back into the granite and methane. The wheel turns for all life. It is all temporary. And they, these madmen, respond to the granite, the dust, the longing of the inanimate. They want to aid Natur. And he thought, I know why. They want to be the agents, not the victims of history. They identify with God's power and believe they are godlike. That is their basic madness. They are overcome by some archetype. Their egos have expanded psychotically so that they cannot tell where they begin and the Godhead leaves off. It is not hubris, not pride. It is inflation of the ego to its ultimate. Confusion between him who worships and that which is worshipped. Man has not eaten God. God has eaten man. What they do not comprehend is man's helplessness. I am weak, small, of no consequence to the universe. It does not notice me. I live on unseen. But why is that bad? Isn't it better that way? Whom the gods notice, they destroy. Be small, and you will escape the jealousy of the great. As he unfastened his own belt, Bane said, Mr. Lotze, I have never told anyone this. I am a Jew. Do you understand? Lotze stared at him piteously. You would not have known, Bane said, because I do not in any physical way appear Jewish. I have had my nose altered, my large greasy pores made smaller, my skin chemically lightened, the shape of my skull changed. In short, physically, I cannot be detected. I can and have often walked in the highest circles of Nazi society. No one will ever discover me. And, he paused, standing close, very close to Lotze, and speaking in a low voice which only Lotze could hear. And there are others of us. Do you hear? We did not die. We still exist. We live on unseen. After a moment, Lotze stuttered. The security police, the SD can go over my record. Bane said, you can report me, but I have very high connections. Some of them are Aryan, some are other Jews in top positions in Berlin. Your report will be discounted, and then presently I will report you. And through these same connections, you will find yourself in protective custody. He smiled, nodded, and walked up the aisle of the ship, away from Lotze, to join the other passengers. Everyone descended the ramp onto the cold, windy field. At the bottom, Baines found himself once more momentarily near Lotze. In fact, Baines said, walking beside Lotze, I do not like your looks, Mr. Lotze, so I think I will report you anyhow. He strode on, then, leaving Lotze behind. At the far end of the field, at the concourse entrance, a large number of people were waiting. Relatives, friends of passengers, some of them waving, peering, smiling, looking anxious, scanning faces. A heavy-set, middle-aged Japanese man, well-dressed in a British overcoat, pointed oxfords, bowler, stood a little ahead of the others with a younger Japanese beside him. On his coat lapel, he wore the badge of the ranking Pacific Trade Mission of the Imperial Government. There he is, Baines realized. Mr. N. Tagomi, come personally to meet me. Starting forward, the Japanese called, Herr Baines, good evening. His head tilted hesitantly. Good evening, Mr. Tagomi, Baines said, holding out his hand. They shook, then bowed. The younger Japanese also bowed, beaming. Bit cold, sir, on this exposed field, Mr. Tagomi said. We shall begin return trip to downtown city by mission helicopter. Is that so? Or do you need to use the facilities and so forth? He scrutinized Mr. Baines's face anxiously. We can start right now, Spain, said, I want to check in at my hotel. My baggage, however, Mr. Kotomichi will attend to that, Mr. Takomi said. He will follow. You see, sir, at this terminal it takes almost an hour waiting in line to claim baggage. Longer than your trip. Mr. Kotomichi smiled agreeably. All right, Bain said. Mr. Takomi said, Sir, I have a gift to graft. I beg your pardon, Bain said. To invite your favorable attitude. Mr. Takomi reached into his overcoat pocket and brought out a small box. Selected from among the finest objets d'art of America available. He held out the box. Well, Bain said, thanks. He accepted the box. All afternoon, assorted officials examined the alternatives, Mr. Takomi said. This is most authentic of dying old U.S. culture, a rare, retained artifact carrying flavor of bygone halcyon day. Mr. Baines opened the box. In it lay a Mickey Mouse wristwatch on a pad of black velvet. Was Mr. Takomi playing a joke on him? He raised his eyes, saw Mr. Tagomi's tense, concerned face. No, it was not a joke. Thank you very much, Bain said. This is indeed incredible. Only few, perhaps 10, authentic 1938 Mickey Mouse watches in all world today. Mr. Tagomi said, studying him, drinking in his reaction, his appreciation. No collector known to me has one, sir. They entered the air terminal and together ascended the ramp. Behind them, Mr. Kotomichi said, Harusame ni nuretsutsu, yane no tamarikana. What is that? Mr. Bain said to Mr. Takomi. Old poem, Mr. Takomi said, middle Tokugawa period. Mr. Kotomichi said, as the spring rains fall, soaking in them on the roof is a child's rag ball. Chapter 4. As Frank Frink watched his ex-employer waddle down the corridor and into the main work area of WM Corporation, he thought to himself, the strange thing about Wyndham Matson is that he does not look like a man who owns a factory. He looks like a tenderloin bum, a wino, who has been given a bath, new clothes, a shave, haircut, shot of vitamins, and set out into the world with $5 to find a new life. The old man had a weak, shifty, nervous, even ingratiating manner, as if he regarded everyone as a potential enemy stronger than he, whom he had to fawn on and pacify. They're going to get me, his manner seemed to say. And yet old WM was really very powerful. He owned controlling interests in a variety of enterprises, speculations, real estate, as well as a WM Corporation factory. Following after the old man, Frink pushed open the big metal door to the main work area. The rumble of machinery, which he had heard around him every day for so long, sight of men at the machines, air filled with flash of light, waste, dust, movement. There went the old man. Frink increased his pace. Hey, Mr. WM, he called. The old man had stopped by the hairy-armed shop foreman, Ed McCarthy. Both of them glanced up as Frink came toward them. Moistening his lips nervously, Wyndham Matson said, I'm sorry, Frank, I can't do anything about taking you back. I've already gone ahead and hired someone to take your place, thinking you weren't coming back, after what you said. His small round eyes flickered with what Frink knew to be an almost hereditary evasiveness. It was in the old man's blood. Frink said, I came for my tools, nothing else. His own voice, he was glad to hear, was firm, even harsh. Well, let's see, W.M. mumbled, obviously hazy in his own mind as to the status of Frink's tools. To Ed McCarthy, he said, I think that would be in your department, Ed. Maybe you can fix Frank here up. I have other business. He glanced at his pocket watch. Listen, Ed, I'll discuss that invoice later. I have to run along. He patted Ed McCarthy on the arm and then trotted off, not looking back. Ed McCarthy and Frink stood together. You came to get your job back, McCarthy said after a time. Yes, Frink said. I was proud of what you said yesterday. So was I, Frink said. But, Christ, I can't work it out anywhere else. He felt defeated and hopeless. You know that. The two of them had in the past often talked over their problems. McCarthy said, I don't know that. You're as good with that flex cable machine as anybody on the coast. I've seen you whip out a piece in 5 minutes, including the rouge polishing, all the way from the rough cratex. And except for the welding, I never said I could weld, Frink said. Did you ever think of going into business on your own? Frink, taken by surprise, stammered, What doing? Jewelry. Oh, for Christ's sake. Custom, original pieces, not commercial. McCarthy beckoned him over to a corner of the shop, away from the noise. For about $2,000, you could set up a little basement or garage shop. One time I drew up designs for women's earrings and pendants. You remember, real modern, contemporary. Taking scratch paper, he began to draw, slowly, grimly. Peering over his shoulder, Frink saw a bracelet design, an abstract with flowing lines. Is there a market? All he had ever seen were the traditional, even antique, objects from the past. Nobody wants contemporary American. There isn't any such thing, not since the war. Create a market, McCarthy said with an angry grimace. You mean sell it myself? Take it into retail shops. Like that, what's it called, on Montgomery Street, that big ritzy art object place? American Artistic Handcrafts, Frink said. He never went into fashionable, expensive stores such as that. Few Americans did. It was the Japanese who had the money to buy from such places. You know what retailers like that are selling, McCarthy said, and getting a fortune for? Those goddamn silver belt buckles from New Mexico that the Indians make. Those goddamn tourist trash pieces, all alike, supposedly native art. For a long time, Frink regarded McCarthy. I know what else they sell, he said finally, and so do you. Yes, McCarthy said. They both knew because they had both been directly involved, and for a long time. WM Corporation's stated legal business consisted in turning out wrought iron staircases, railings, fireplaces, and ornaments for new apartment buildings, all on a mass basis from standard designs. For a new 40-unit building, the same piece would be executed 40 times in a row. Ostensibly, WM Corporation was an iron foundry, but in addition, it maintained another business from which its real profits were derived. Using an elaborate variety of tools, materials, and machines, WM Corporation turned out a constant flow of forgeries of pre-war American artifacts. These forgeries were cautiously but expertly fed into the wholesale art object market to join the genuine objects collected throughout the continent. As in the stamp and coin business, no one could possibly estimate the percentage of forgeries in circulation. And no one, especially the dealers and the collectors themselves, wanted to. When Frink had quit, there lay half-finished on his bench a Colt revolver of the frontier period. He had made the molds himself, done the casting, and had been busy hand-smoothing the pieces. There was an unlimited market for small arms of the American Civil War and frontier period. WM Corporation could sell all that Frink could turn out. It was his specialty. Walking slowly over to his bench, Frink picked up the still rough and burred ramrod of the revolver. Another 3 days and the gun would be finished. Yes, he thought, it was good work. An expert could have told the difference, but the Japanese collectors weren't authorities in the proper sense, had no standards or tests by which to judge. In fact, as far as he knew, it had never occurred to them to ask themselves if the so-called historic art objects for sale in West Coast shops were genuine. Perhaps someday they would. And then the bubble would burst. The market would collapse even for the authentic pieces. A Gresham's law, the fakes would undermine the value of the real. And that, no doubt, was the motive for the failure to investigate. After all, everyone was happy. The factories, here and there in the various cities which turned out the pieces, they made their profits. The wholesalers passed them on, and the dealers displayed and advertised them. The collectors shelled out their money and carried their purchases happily home to impress their associates, friends, and mistresses. Like post-war boodle paper money, it was fine until questioned. Nobody was hurt until the day of reckoning. And then everyone equally would be ruined. But meanwhile, nobody talked about it. Even the men who earned their living turning out the forgeries, they shut their own minds to what they made, kept their attention on the mere technical problems. How long since you tried to do original designing? McCarthy asked. Frink shrugged. Years. I can copy accurately as hell, but you know what I think? I think you've picked up the Nazi idea that Jews can't create. That they can only imitate and sell middlemen. He fixed his merciless scrutiny on Frink. Maybe so, Frink said. Try it. Do some original designs, or work directly on the metal. Play around like a kid plays. No, Frink said. You have no faith, McCarthy said. You've completely lost faith in yourself, right? Too bad. Because I know you could do it. He walked away from the workbench. It is too bad, Frink thought. But nevertheless, it's the truth. It's a fact. I can't get faith or enthusiasm by willing it, deciding to. That McCarthy, he thought, is a damn good shop foreman. He has the knack of needling a man, getting him to put out his best efforts, to do his utmost in spite of himself. He's a natural leader. He almost inspired me for a moment there. But McCarthy had gone off now. The effort had failed. Too bad I don't have my copy of the Oracle here, Frink thought. I could consult it on this, take the issue to it for its 5,000 years of wisdom. And then he recalled that there was a copy of the I Ching in the lounge of the business office of WM Corporation. So he made his way from the work area along the corridor, hurriedly through the business office to the lounge. Seated in one of the chrome and plastic lounge chairs, he wrote his question out on the back of an envelope. Should I attempt to go into the creative private business outlined to me just now? And then he began throwing the coins. The bottom line was a 7, and so was the second and then the third. The bottom trigram in Qian, he realized. That sounded good. Qian was the creative. Then line 4, an 8, Yin. And line 5, also 8, a Yin line. Good Lord, he thought excitedly. One more Yin line and I've got hexagram 11. Tai, peace. Very favorable judgment. Or, his hands trembled as he rattled the coins, a Yang line and hence hexagram 26, Ta Chu, the taming power of the great. Both have favorable judgments, and it has to be one or the other. He threw the 3 coins. Yin, a 6. It was peace. Opening the book, he read the judgment. Peace. The small departs. The great approaches. Good fortune. Success. So I ought to do as Ed McCarthy says. Open my little business. Now the 6 at the top, my one moving line, he turned the page. What was the text? He could not recall. Probably favorable because the hexagram itself was so favorable. Union of heaven and earth, but the first and last lines were outside the hexagram always, so possibly the 6 at the top. His eyes picked out the line, read it in a flash. The wall falls back into the moat. Use no army now. Make your commands known within your own town. Perseverance brings humiliation. My busted back, he exclaimed, horrified. And the commentary, the change alluded to in the middle of the hexagram has begun to take place. The wall of the town sinks back into the moat from which it was dug. The hour of doom is at hand. It was, beyond doubt, one of the most dismal lines in the entire book of more than 3,000 lines. And yet the judgment of the hexagram was good. Which was he supposed to follow? And how could they be so different? It had never happened to him before, good fortune and doom mixed together in the oracle's prophecy. What a weird fate. As if the oracle had scraped the bottom of the barrel, tossed up every sort of rag, bone, and turd of the dark, then reversed itself and poured in the light like a cook gone barmy. I must have pressed two buttons at once, he decided. Jammed the works and got this schlimmozzle's eye view of reality. Just for a second, fortunately. Didn't last. Hell, he thought. It has to be one or the other. It can't be both. You can't have good fortune and doom simultaneously. Or can you? The jewelry business will bring good fortune. The judgment refers to that. But the line, the goddamn line, it refers to something deeper, some future catastrophe probably not even connected with the jewelry business. Some evil fate that's in store for me anyhow. War, he thought. Third World War. All frigging 2 billion of us killed, our civilization wiped out. Hydrogen bombs falling like hail. Oy, gewalt, he thought. What's happening? Did I start it in motion? Or is someone else tinkering? Someone I don't even know. Or the whole lot of us? It's the fault of those physicists and that synchronicity theory, every particle being connected with every other. You can't fart without changing the balance in the universe. It makes living a funny joke with nobody around to laugh. I open a book and get a report on future events that even God would like to file and forget. And who am I? The wrong person, I can tell you that. I should take my tools, get my motors from McCarthy, open my shop, start my piddling business, go on despite the horrible line. Be working, creating in my own way, right up to the end, living as best I can, as actively as possible, until the wall falls back into the moat for all of us, all mankind. That's what the oracle is telling me. Fate will poleaxe us, eventually, anyhow, but I have my job in the meantime. I must use my mind, my hands. The judgment was for me alone, for my work. But the line, it was for us all. I'm too small, he thought. I can only read what's written, glance up and then lower my head and plod along where I left off as if I hadn't seen. The oracle doesn't expect me to start running up and down the streets, squalling and yammering for public attention. Can anyone alter it? He wondered. All of us combined, or one great figure, or someone strategically placed who happens to be in the right spot? Chance. Accident. And our lives, our world, hanging on it. Closing the book, he left the lounge and walked back to the main work area. When he caught sight of McCarthy, he waved him over to one side where they could resume talk. The more I think about it, Frink said, the more I like your idea. Fine, McCarthy said. Now listen, here's what you do. You have to get money from Wyndham Matson. He winked, a slow, intense, frightened twitch of his eyelid. I figured out how. I'm going to quit and go in with you. My designs, see? What's wrong with that? I know they're good. Sure, Frink said, a little dazed. I'll see you after work tonight, McCarthy said, at my apartment. You come over around 7 and have dinner with Jean and me, if you can stand the kids. Okay, Frink said. McCarthy gave him a slap on the shoulder and went off. I've gone a long way, Frink said to himself, in the last 10 minutes. But he did not feel apprehensive. He felt, now, excitement. It sure happened fast, he thought as he walked over to his bench and began collecting his tools. I guess that's how those kinds of things happen. Opportunity, when it comes. All my life I've waited for this. When the oracle says something must be achieved, it means this. The time is truly great. What is the time now? What is this moment? 6 at the top in hexagram 11 changes everything to 26, taming power of the great. Yin becomes yang. The line moves and a new moment appears. And I was so off stride I didn't even notice. I'll bet that's why I got that terrible line. That's the only way hexagram 11 can change to hexagram 26, by that moving 6 at the top. So I shouldn't get my ass in such an uproar. but despite his excitement and optimism, he could not get the line completely out of his mind. However, he thought ironically, I'm making a damn good try. By 7 tonight, maybe I'll have managed to forget it like it never happened. He thought, I sure hope so. Because this get-together with Ed is big. He's got some surefire idea, I can tell, and I don't intend to find myself left out. Right now, I'm nothing, but if I can swing this, then maybe I can get Juliana back. I know what she wants. She deserves to be married to a man who matters, an important person in the community, not some Michiganer. Men used to be men in the old days, before the war, for instance. But all that's gone now. No wonder she roams around from place to place, from man to man, seeking, and not even knowing what it is herself, what her biology needs. But I know. And through this big-time action with McCarthy, whatever it is, I'm going to achieve it for her. At lunchtime, Robert Childen closed up American Artistic Handcrafts, Incorporated. Usually he crossed the street and ate at the coffee shop. In any case, he stayed away no more than half an hour, and today he was gone only 20 minutes. Memory of his ordeal with Mr. Tagomi and the staff of the trade mission still kept his stomach upset. As he returned to his store, he said to himself, perhaps new policy of not making calls. Do all business within store. 2 hours showing, much too long. Almost 4 hours in all, too late to reopen store. An entire afternoon to sell one item, one Mickey Mouse watch. Expensive treasure, but he unlocked the store door, propped it open, went to hang up his coat in the rear. When he re-emerged, he found that he had a customer, a white man. Well, he thought, surprise. Good day, sir, Childen said, bowing slightly. Probably a Pinoc. Slender, rather dark man, well-dressed, fashionable, but not at ease, slight shine of perspiration. Good day, the man murmured, moving around the store to inspect the displays. Then all at once he approached the counter. He reached into his coat, produced a small, shiny leather card case, set down a multicolored, elaborately printed card. On the card, the imperial emblem, and military insignia, the Navy. Admiral Harusha. Robert Childen examined it, impressed. The Admiral's ship, the customer explained, lies in San Francisco Bay at this moment. The carrier Sayokaku. Ah, Childen said. Admiral Harusha has never before visited the West Coast, the customer explained. He has many wishes while here, one of which is to pay personal visit to your famous store, all the time in the home islands he has heard of American Artistic Handcrafts, Incorporated. Childen bowed with delight. However, the man continued, due to pressure of appointments, the Admiral cannot pay personal visit to your esteemed store, but he has sent me. I am his gentleman. The Admiral is a collector? Childen said, his mind working at top speed. He is a lover of the arts, he is a connoisseur, but not a collector. What he desires is for gift purposes, to wit, he wishes to present each officer of his ship a valuable historic artifact, a sidearm of the epic American Civil War. The man paused. There are 12 officers in all. To himself, Childen thought, 12 Civil War sidearms cost to buyer almost $10,000. He trembled. As is well known, the man continued, your shop sells such priceless antique artifacts from the pages of American history, alas, all too rapidly vanishing into limbo of time. Taking enormous care in his words, he could not afford to lose this, to make one single slip. Childen said, yes, it is true. Of all the stores in PSA, I possess finest stock imaginable of Civil War weapons. I will be happy to serve Admiral Harusha. Shall I gather superb collection of such and bring aboard the Sayokaku? This afternoon, possibly? The man said, no, I shall inspect them here. 12, Childen computed. He did not possess 12. In fact, he had only 3. but he could acquire 12, if luck were with him, through various channels within the week. Air Express from the East, for instance, and local wholesale contacts. "You, sir," Childan said, "are knowledgeable in such weapons?"
"Tolerably," the man said. "I have a small collection of hand weapons, including tiny secret pistol made to look like domino, circa 1840.
"Exquisite item," Childan said, as he went to the locked safe to get several guns for Admiral Harusha's gentleman's inspection. When he returned, he found the man writing out a bank check. The man paused and said, "The Admiral desires to pay in advance a deposit of 15,000 PSA dollars. The room swam before Childan's eyes, but he managed to keep his voice level. He even made himself sound a trifle bored.
"If you wish, it is not necessary, a mere formality of business."
Laying down a leather and felt box, he said, "Here is exceptional Colt 44 of 1860. He opened the box. "Black powder and ball. This issued to U.S. Army. Boys in blue carried these into, for instance, Second Bull Run." For a considerable time, the man examined the Colt 44. Then, lifting his eyes, he said calmly, "Sir, this is an imitation."
"Eh?" Childan said, not comprehending.
"This piece is no older than 6 months. Sir, your offering is a fake. I am cast into gloom. But see, the wood here, artificially aged by an acid chemical. What a shame." He laid the gun down. Childan picked the gun up and stood holding it between his hands. He could think of nothing to say. Turning the gun over and over, he at last said, "It can't be." "An imitation of the authentic historic gun, nothing more. I am afraid, sir, you have been deceived. Perhaps by some unscrupulous churl. You must report this to the San Francisco police." The man bowed. "It grieves me. You may have other imitations, too, in your shop. Is it possible, sir, that you, the owner, dealer in such items, cannot distinguish the forgeries from the real?" There was silence. Reaching down, the man picked up the half-completed check which he had been making out. He returned it to his pocket, put his pen away, and bowed. "It is a shame, sir, but I clearly cannot, alas, conduct my business with American Artistic Handcrafts Incorporated after all. Admiral Harusha will be disappointed. Nevertheless, you can see my position." Childan stared down at the gun. "Good day, sir," the man said. "Please accept my humbly meant advice. Hire some expert to scrutinize your acquisitions."
"Your reputation? I am sure you understand."
Childan mumbled,
"Sir, if you could please..."
"Be tranquil, sir. I will not mention this to anyone. I shall tell the Admiral that, unfortunately, your shop was closed today."
"After all..." The man paused at the doorway.
"We are both, after all, white men."
Bowing once more, he departed.
This ends side one of cassette 2. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.